Marilyn Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 26, delivered on November 21.
Today, incremental cash flow example. Before I do that, and then I'll give a quiz, and then you will be gone for the day. But just to start things off on a perhaps less than joyful note, the markets are broadly down today. Although it's not each one isn't a terribly significant amount down, the cumulative effect of all of the markets showing weakness and a tendency, slight tendency toward bear dominance is indicative that it is a bad day overall. Going quickly, we see even gold is down. So the money is coming out of going out of equities, going out of gold. Let's see if it's going into bonds at all. Well, where in the world would... Yes. As you can see, that's a pretty decent upsurge on the price of bonds today. So bonds are the beneficiaries of the movement of capital out of the equities and even out of the metals. So we have a good day on the bonds as far as that goes, which means as the bond prices are going up, the bond yields are going down. So we're having a little bit of easing of the pressure on the bond markets, at least for the day, at least if we're going into the midday today. But there is definitely a sour note in the equities, as you can see. This is just a day, if you look at the Standard & Poor's 500, you can see that this is a day that had a fairly smooth start, but then there was this hard surge, as you can see on the spike there, and that was where the cliff came and the bears had some fun a couple of times. And the markets crawled back out of it to some extent, but we're still having that trend downward through the into the midday. So for what that's worth, we are having negative sentiment in the market. Although it's good news that the bond market has recovered a little bit, so we have a little bit of, as I said, pressure being let off the equities market. Now, a couple of things to start this ball rolling. As I said, we would have an example of an actual free cash flow analysis. And this is incremental free cash flows that were used in an actual situation. Now, these numbers are simplified to some extent, and just for the sake of making it a little easier to see the calculations that were going on. And the project's life was 4 years of operations. There was a lead-in year, and then there was a tailing year. So there is a year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. This was a project to bring to market a router for the Internet of Things. And I won't tell you the name of the company. It's actually kind of a blend of two here. But the project starts off with the assumption that this company could do well to enter the consumer market. It had not typically been there, and it wanted to see if it had its name could carry from the business community into the consumer community. The project was going to cost a pretty darn good whack up front. A total of $6.5 million. Now I'm going to show you these numbers, and if you want to pull out your Excel and try to follow along, you can. I'm going to put this up on the on ReggieNet. I tried to do it this morning, and then it started fussing when you upload it and then you test it to see if you can open it up, and it said the file was corrupted, which is not so, but one way or the other, I'll make sure that I can get it up there. If need be, I'll put it onto my private web server and give you a link to it that way. But one way or the other, this will be up there on the interweb for you, and you can see this for yourself, or you can follow along and key in the formulas yourself, or you can write them down. But one way or the other, we start, there's this thing in most fields right now, there's this idea that you have to learn Excel. And you have to just get numbers in there and wow people with these big, complicated spreadsheets. And that's what it's all about. And actually, that's really bad form. It is a lot better if you kind of separate two different parts, or actually three different parts. I do two different parts in this. And you'll see what I mean. On one sheet, I put all of the numerical assumptions. And that way, and then there's a front sheet where I actually use them to do the calculations. In that way, first of all, I'm not making the front end sheet as complicated as it would be if those assumptions were numbers there. The second thing is, then I can just change numbers on the assumption sheet and everything changes on the front end. I don't have to go into the formulas and fix things and change numbers there. So you'll see what I mean here in the Internet of Things incremental free cash flow analysis. I have a fairly bland looking assumptions sheet. I'm not having people see that. That's not going to be an end user kind of document. And as a matter of fact, in a good corporate best practices, you lock this sheet so that these people cannot go in there and change things around for their own purposes. But one way or the other, you notice it's a fairly bland sheet. It doesn't look like it's much of anything at all. But it has the information that I want. This company was going to sell these at a wholesale price of $200 to electronics retailers like Best Buy, Circuit City at the time. I'm not sure which ones, I can't remember if they were doing Best Buy, Circuit City, but they were going to sell it to a retail company, retailers, at $200 a box. It was going to cost them $90 a unit to have it made in China. Now, if you, I've mentioned this before, but on the mainland and in Taiwan, they will do whatever they can to get your business. They'll make it, they'll put it in a pretty box, and they'll even ship it to the stores you want them to ship it to. I know this from personal experience going back to the 1980s with the product that I had produced on Taiwan. They put it in a pretty little box. They even put these things in little pouches for me. And then they even gave us point-of-purchase displays to put them on. And they said, you tell us how many units, where, and we'll ship them there. So these are one-stop fulfillment houses. And that by that fulfillment means that they will box it, ship it to wherever you want for you. Amazon does fulfillment as well. As a matter of fact, they're bitching at me because I won't join with my products, my artwork, I won't join Amazon Prime. They say, you just send us your prints and we'll package them up, we'll make them pretty and we'll ship them out as your orders come in. And I can't seem to convince them, no, this is artwork. I can't do that. They are created, and then they are signed. But one way or the other, Amazon fulfills. So when you see this $90 cost of the outsource, that was everything. Front to back, build the router, put it in a nice, pretty little plastic bag, slide it into a nice oblong rectangular box with four-color printing on it, and then stack them up and ship them to wherever this company wanted. So in other words, they were going to sell it 200, and it was going to cost them $90 a unit. Now the thing here is that the term we use, and it's actually kind of a wrong term, but we call this unit margin, the difference between the unit price and the unit cost of the good. It's not really a good word term because margin usually refers to a ratio, but it's been around for so long that I use it myself. So the unit margin for this Internet of Things router, this IOTA router, was $110. Now they were projecting, these numbers are in hundreds of thousands. They were projecting that they would sell 8 million of the units. 8 million? No, 800,000 of the units. Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. So, okay. So, in other words, we would, and one of the simplifications is that in my representation of this, they start selling their full batch of units, and they sell out those 80 every year and bring in another 80 to sell for the next year through the life of the project. So the units sold is 80,000 units. So your revenue would be $8 million here. Now the cost of goods sold, and I'm showing you how we do it, and I talked about this on Tuesday. The 45% of revenue, that's just what it's going to cost us for these. That's where we get the $90. And then the sales, general, and administrative. This was entirely lab costs. They had to build a laboratory that would test these units as it came in for quality and for safety. Quality, you didn't want some crap that people would buy and then it wouldn't work and then you get a bad reputation because it had your company's name on it. And also for safety, because this was electrical, and anything electrical, you don't want that thing to give someone a fried bacon burn from using it or burn down a house. So the lab was there, and it was staffed with technicians and oversight personnel. That was where the administration of the product division was going to be held. It was running at 25% of revenue. That was their target, and once the project was over, they did a darn fine job of holding that target, almost lock on at 25% through the 4 years. So they set this as a goal, and they managed to keep it. Okay, this was the lab was going to cost $6.5 million. It was going to cost them a pretty hefty amount. Now, that's the capital expenditure up front. That's cash outflow, free cash outflow. However, for accounting purposes, they had to depreciate it. Now, here again is another simplifying assumption. For this example I'm showing in class here, we straight line. They actually did MACRS, Modified Accelerated Cost Recovery System. It really didn't make a lot of difference. But anyway, it just makes it easier. 6.5 divided by 5 every year. Now, their marginal tax rate, that was what it was at the time, this company. The last dollar they earned, they paid 39% on that dollar in taxes. Right now, that number would be 21%. Guarantee you that if we have a new administration come to power, that tax rate ain't going to be any 21%. Yeah, that's going to be the last time you see that in forever, considering what it's doing to our budget deficits, giving that free candy to all the corporations. Now, here's the important thing. They are going to sell these units. And over the course of a year, they will see, because of this project, because of this product, they will have an increase in their accounts receivable by 15%. They will have just a boost up. The retailers are going to buy it. Some they'll buy with cash, and the rest they'll buy on the terms. 210 a net 90 or something like that. But they will see a 15% increase in their accounts receivable during the life of the project. So they'll also see their own accounts payable, what they owe to the Chinese manufacturer, go up by 15%. They're not going to pay the instant they order. They're going to pay on it's over a period of time. So on average, on every year, there's going to be a 15% boost in the accounts payable in the company vis-a-vis what it would be otherwise. Salvage value. They did have environmental remediation costs. They were pretty costly on that lab. Before they could sell it, they had to clean it up. But also, because the project was not that long-lived, it was like 4 years, 5 years, the equipment was still worth decent money in the secondary market. So they actually came out slightly ahead on salvage value. Not a huge amount, but that's an interesting thing about projects that don't last a long, long time. Because if it lasts a long time, the equipment would be antiquated, it would be worn out, it might even not be able to be used because of compliance. But because the project was short-lived, they actually were able to sell the stuff in that lab, the testing equipment, even the chairs and tables and everything like that, at something of a decent price. So they came out a little bit ahead. Now, just for the purposes of this, this was actually the discount rate that was used, to the best of my knowledge. I can't prove it, but I'm pretty sure it was a 12% discount rate. How did they come up with that? I don't know. I am hopeful that they came up with it using the capital asset pricing model, but I can't tell you that. So now, I tried to white out all of the numbers to show you everything going along, but it didn't work. So what I'm going to do is, line by line, I'm going to open this up. The revenues. Mother's work is never done. As you can see, that is going to be, and you'll see right up here, I did absolute references. When you go to that assumption sheet, you use absolute references so that when you sweep and copy it across, it holds on to that number that was there on this sheet. So in other words, it's the unit margin I used. So I said, all right, I want you to take the unit margin as an absolute reference and then times it by the number of units they sell as an absolute reference. That's why you see these two absolute references here, because, as I said, I simplified it so that it was a flat income stream, revenue stream across. Cost of goods sold, I did the same thing. I just had an absolute reference to the cost of the units, and I said, okay, the cost of goods sold is going to be 45% of revenues. So I took the absolute reference of the unit cost right here, and then I just times it by the number above, and that's where I got that. And if you take that across, well, actually, I could do all of these. Notice one quick thing before I go on, and this should help you a lot in the homework. This is a little bit more intense than what you get in your homework. But if you're going on in finance, this is definitely... I'll teach you exactly. As a matter of fact, I'm going to use this same example in 341 in about 3 hours, 2.5 hours. Okay, so anyway, now we can see the gross margin. We can highlight that. It's just the revenues minus cost. But notice something interestingly. The operating phase of the company is this block right here. There is this place, this dead zone at the beginning and the end, where you're not getting any revenue and you're not incurring any costs. This is where all that's going to happen is expenses on the front end, your capital expenditures. And on the back end, you get this weird combination of things happening. Okay, selling, general, and administrative. Again, I've got an assumption sheet. I say it is going to be 25% as an absolute reference of the revenue. And notice that that means that if I said, well, what if it were 30%? I just go to the assumption sheet and change that to 30, and all the numbers change on the fly. Now, straight line. Here's an interesting thing that's happening in this problem. This has a depreciable life of 5 years, but the project had a service life, an operating life of 4 years. So I'm just going to take, okay, the capital expenditure was right here, this 800-pound gorilla of capital expenditure, $6.5 million. And that $6.5 million, and I'm going to straight line it, I'm going to take the $6.5 million times 1 divided by the number of straight line years, which was 5 years. It was depreciated, it was capitalized right here. But then it was expensed out over 5 years at $1.3 million a year. So finally, I can take my gross margin minus my selling, general, and administrative minus my depreciations, and here we have, here we have the earnings before interest and taxes. EBIT. Okay. Notice something interestingly. EBITs are not zero in the fifth year. You actually have a negative amount of money at the earnings before interest and taxes line, which means that you have a negative tax bill in the fifth year. You actually have a negative tax bill in the fifth year because you're in the fifth year, you're not bringing any money in, you're not paying anything out as far as costs go, but you've got this minus $1,300 on the income statement, which means that you get to you get actually a break on your taxes. And I'm going to bring up another example here in just a little bit. Okay, now the tax, and that's not correct there. Actually, I wrote that, but it's not. The tax was 39%. The tax at 39%, as you can see, is just going to be EBIT minus your tax bill. And again, notice all I have to do is take that number times, over here, my marginal tax rate. And I make that marginal tax rate an absolute reference so that as I sweep that across and copy it, it doesn't move the tax, it doesn't move the tax rate cell. And if you take your earnings before interest and taxes minus your tax, there you be. That is NOPAT. Net operating profit after tax. NOPAT. This is where we go away from the first place we go away from accounting, because they would drill it down minus interest expense is EBIT minus interest expense is earnings before taxes minus taxes is net income. We stop because our discount rate already includes the tax effect of interest expense deduction. And then we add back the depreciation and amortization, just like I showed you, because that didn't really happen. We include it because it created a tax shield, but now we have to add it back. That's cash flow that didn't get lost. And then now here's the pain in the butt. The receivables went up by 15% of the incremental revenues. So in other words, our revenues went up by 8,800. So 15% of that didn't actually happen in cash. So our receivables went up by $1,320. And that was their receivables were going to be that 15% of revenue for all of the years that we had the project. The payables did the same thing. The payables went up by 15% of cost of goods sold every year that we were buying the product from the Chinese. So now comes the interesting part. The change in net working capital. You see, because I went from this minus this to this minus this. So I actually bled real cash. $1,320 did not come in, and $594 did not go out. So I lost $726. I slipped down by the difference between the increase in the payables and the receivables. However, in the next year, as a matter of fact, let me do something right here. I'm going to do the net operating working capital itself, just to show you this. Equals this minus this. And now let me take that across. Notice something. That the change in net working capital, what from year zero to year one, was $726. So that means that I bled that much money. Net working capital went up. Money disappeared from the coffers and into receivables. But then, over the next years, net working capital stayed the same. So there was no change in net working capital in years 2, 3, and 4 of the project. But then, at the end, my receivables all came in, my payables all went out, and so at the end of the project, I was back down to zero contribution from this project. The incremental changed. I recovered my receivables, which had been that $1,500 or $594. I'm sorry, $1,320. And I paid the bills. I finally closed out the books on that running payables. And so at the end, I actually recovered that money that had been absorbed by the project at the beginning. And notice that that'll happen every time. You'll get this little. They show at the beginning the money goes out, at the end it comes back. But of course, this money at the end isn't worth as much now as that money there. So finally, we write our capital expenditures, which amounted to nothing except right up front, knocked us dead up front. And then we put the salvage value back in, which I had already written over here, which was just that little bit of money there. And I can change that salvage value if I want. Okay, and so we can now say the NOPAT, whoops, I don't want to, yeah, I do. Black. We can take the NOPAT plus the depreciation minus the change in net operating working capital minus the capital expenditures plus the salvage value for every year. Now, in some years, there won't be some of these lines, but it's going to be, this number right here is going to be NOPAT plus depreciation plus the change in net operating working capital minus the capital expenditures plus the salvage value. Again, the incremental free cash flow is going to be NOPAT for every year. I just write it once and then copy it across. The NOPAT for the year, add back the depreciation, and then you take out the change in net operating working capital, and then you deal with the capital expenditures, you subtract those out, and you add back the salvage value. Now, the capital expenditures will happen only once. That'll be in the zero year. And the salvage value will happen only once in the end year. But it doesn't matter if they're not there. You can just use them in the formula. They won't have any effect. So I can do it once here, and then I can just grab it and just copy it across. And now, we're going to do the NPV. And this is how you do an NPV in Excel. It's actually very simple. Equals NPV, open the parenthesis, and now I'm going to say it wants you to give it the discount rate first. So I go over here. Notice how I can change it if I want. Comma. And then you give it the chain, the vector of data, the incremental free cash flows, all of them, in one sweep. You close it. Now this is the part, it comes out to be almost just what it was. Do you see it? Do we accept or do we reject? Come on. What do you say? Do we accept or reject? You accept. Do you see how close this was to a flat zero, stupid net present value? It was virtually almost it was almost like not even worth worrying about. In the end, when the project closed down, they looked back, and it turned out the project had made more money than this free cash flow analysis said it would. And the conclusion has been in case studies that the reason it was more profitable than what this says, it's just barely going to be profitable. Go ahead with it, but it's not going to be anything that's going to make the company great. In retrospect, it did do very well for the company. So where did this free cash flow analysis fall down? It didn't really fall down. Here's where the problem was. They used a 12%, which was a very high risk project. In other words, this project probably would have been better at about 10%. But by putting 12% in it, they were taking a very cautious approach, assuming the project was going to be riskier than it actually turned out to be. And even at that, though, the project was a go, if barely a go. But at the same time, that's how we do this thing. It's just like a puzzle. But I can assure you that if you get it, and you will, I'm sure you're going to get into other courses where you need to use Excel. One of the big things that I want to convince you is get your information separated from the calculations. Because that way, if you need to change numbers, do what ifs and all that, all you have to do is change the numbers on this sheet back here. And then this sheet up front, you can make that pretty. And everyone loves pretty. And you can put this up for students in a class to see. You can put it up for members of a board of directors or executive management to see. And it isn't cluttered at all like it would be if I had all of this crap in there as well. If they want to know what those numbers are, you just flip to that and you show it to them. Here it is. But most of the time, your end users are going to see this, and that's going to be what they want. One last little trick here. Equals if that number, I screwed that up. Sorry about that. Okay, let's try that again. I'm going to say if that number right there is greater than or equal to zero, then type yes, by golly. Otherwise, no.
you loser.
So, I should not tell you this story, but we were working in this one project, and this Excel genius had done this, but had an accept and reject. So we changed it to yes, fat boy, and no, you asshole. He didn't know it until he popped it up at this board meeting. False! You lie. Oh, equal to zero. I'm sorry, I screwed up. Equal to zero. Then yes. Yes, you had a question? Okay, I was started getting into my story here. But yeah, you can write whatever you want in these. And it will bind. But anyway, I wanted to show you one real quick thing. I scratched out the numbers. Yeah, I did put it here. Remember I told you about that gluten-free? This won't take but a minute. Then I'll give you your quiz. But I told you about that gluten-free pastry. Just a quick little note on that one. To show you the power of that tax shield from expenditures. The company that did that, and I just scratched these numbers out. The company that did that was going to have $460 million at pre-tax. Okay? This was without the pastry. This is what would have been going on if they hadn't done the pastry. And then they were going to have upfront expenses. I'm not talking about capitalized costs. I'm talking about expenses to get this project started. Was going to cost them $15 million. That's a pretty heavy, even for a company this size, that's pretty significant. That's noticeable. Okay, so now, and I'll use a simplified way of doing this. Let's talk about, so in other words, pre-tax with the project, with the pastry, would be the 460 minus the 15 million, so it'd be 445 million. So obviously they were going to lose some money up front on that first, on the initial year. They were going to eat $15 million in, they weren't capitalizing. This was just expenses to get this thing going. Okay, so now let me show you what happens. Let's say the tax rate, just at the time, it was 39%, but I'll do 40% just to make it simpler looking. So tax would be 40% of 460 if they don't do the project. And 40% of 460 would be, clear, 0.4 times 460 would have been $184 million. Net income. Tax would be, which would be 184 million. So they would have had 460 minus 184, 6, 5 minus 8, 7, 4 minus 1, 376. Is that right? Okay. 460
times 0.6, 276. Wow.
On this one, that would have been 445 times 0.40 times 0.4. That would have been 176. For an after tax, 445 minus 176. Would have been 269. The point, though, is this. Notice something. The project cost them $15 million up front. But if you look at the taxes, look here. Tax without, tax with. The tax without that project, they would have paid the government $184 million. With the project, they paid the government $176 million. So in other words, they got a tax shield of $8 million. If they hadn't taken on the project, they would have paid $184 million in taxes. With the project, they paid $176 million. What that means is that the project generated a tax shield, but what that means is that this project actually did not cost $15 million. It cost $15 million minus the shield. So, this actually means something important. When corporations have high tax rates, they will tend to take on more capital projects, because capital projects create tax shields to protect them from taxes. When you lower their tax rate, it doesn't make as much difference whether they take on the project or not. In other words, we lower their taxes, they save on taxes. We raise their taxes, the only way they can save on taxes is to invest and create the tax shields. In essence, it's a weird thing, and you're not going to hear much about it, but one of the problems we have with dropping corporate tax rates, they just keep the tax dollars. They're not paying as much in taxes. And they say, "What? So what?" But if we actually make it so that the only way they save on taxes is to invest in new technologies, in new jobs, in new products, new services, then suddenly they are all doing it because that's the only way they get their candy. We can give it to them, or we can make them work for it. In other words, we can actually give them welfare, or we can make them work for their paychecks. Now I'm going to give you a quiz.